This is Community in Conversation with Kathy Kayla, starting conversations that matter.
Good morning, I'm Kathy Kayla, and thank you for joining me for this Community in Conversation. We have just celebrated the Chagim, and food is a big part of our observances. Whether we're eating specific symbolic foods at Rosh Hashanah, abstaining on Yom Kippur, or inviting guests to our sukkahs, meat is a big part of those meals. When our forefather Abraham welcomed the angels, we are told that his wife Sarah had to prepare tongue for their guests. In the temple times, the Kohanim consumed the animal sacrifices. Meat is important to us. It is part of our culture. And yet, it has become an ethical and moral issue. So to answer questions around eating meat, I've contacted Rabbi David Rosen. He is the former chief rabbi of Ireland. He currently serves as the American Jewish Committee's International Director of Interreligious Affairs. He headed the International Jewish Committee for Interreligious Consultations. Before being appointed chief rabbi of Ireland, Rabbi Rosen was the senior rabbi of the largest Orthodox Jewish congregation in South Africa. That's the Green and Seapoint Hebrew congregations in Cape Town. And he served as a dayan on the Cape Beth Din. He also serves on the chief rabbinate of Israel's Commission for Interreligious Relations. He's an international president of Religions for Peace and serves as the only Jewish representative on the board of directors of the KAICIID, founded by King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. His awards are too numerous to mention here, but he is a knight. He was made a knight commander of the Order of St. Gregory the Great. He also received a Commander of the Order of the British Empire, that's a CBE, by Queen Elizabeth. Welcome, Rabbi. How are you?
Fine, thank you, Kathy. Greetings from Jerusalem.
Is eating meat a moral or a religious choice?
It is a personal choice, and it is nevertheless associated very much with religious practice, especially when the Beit HaMikdash, when the temple was standing. And within the ancient world, meat was not readily available, and therefore it was seen very much as a delicacy and probably was a necessary part, and certainly in many times and places, of ensuring that people got them adequate nutrients. But there is no mitzvah to eat meat. The language that there is no simcha with meat and wine, that of course is to be found in Tractate Pesachim, where incidentally it goes on to say, and since the temple has been destroyed, there is no joy except with wine. It doesn't add meat. Though it's true that Rambam Maimonides in his code does talk about eating meat and wine. But then so many commentators, and there's a whole slew of them brought by an encyclopedic work by Rabbi Hizkiah Medini, which is actually just behind me, Sfei Chemed. And in that work, he brings all the different sources that say, obviously, it's a simcha, a joy, to have meat and wine if you like meat and wine. If you don't like meat and wine, then obviously not. But today we face a more critical issue, and that is the question as to whether the meat is actually kosher, whether, in fact, it is legitimate to be part of consumption that is produced through enormous barbarity and cruelty, way beyond that which Judaism would normally permit to allow people to partake of animal flesh.
Before we get to answering the question of if today's meat is even kosher at all, help us to see the big picture. We know that if we want to understand the essence or the spirit of something, we go back to the first time that it's mentioned in the Torah. Where is eating meat first mentioned in the Torah, Rabbi?
Yes, well, first of all, that's a really important point. Let's go back to the beginning of eating before we get to meat. Where's the first eating? The first eating, of course, is to the first human beings, to Eve and Adam. And in the Garden of Eden, they are given all the herbs and fruits of the garden to partake of. They are, in fact, vegetarians, and they might even be vegans. They are living on a plant-based diet. It is only when humanity corrupts itself and demonstrates that being able to live on a really the highest levels is very, very difficult, and as a concession to human failure. After the flood, God permits humanity to partake of animal flesh. But it's very clear from the language that it's concession. And indeed, this is very much the basis for writings such as the writings of Rabbi Cook and before him, Rabbi Yosef Albo, the authority behind the Sefer Ikarim, and the Abar Bamel and others, who point out that this is to accommodate a human being's lusts. Or to use the language of the Talmud, Keneged Yetzer Hara Dibra HaTorah, Torah speaks concerning the evil inclination. In other words, rather than trying to eliminate ineffectively a human impetus, instinct, the Torah seeks to wean us away from these things in order to raise us to a higher level. So meat eating is allowed in the Torah, but it's certainly not an ideal. The very language is clear. Again, the sources I mentioned point out the word ta'ava is used, and ta'ava means lust. And if you lust to eat meat, then this is the way to do it. In fact, many people are familiar with the writings of Rabbi Cook, but not so many are familiar with the writings of Rabbi J.B. Soloveitchik, one of the great illustrious Orthodox leaders of American Korea, World Korea, and he writes a very passionate article in which he goes further than Rabbi Cook and affirms the need for Jews who want to live on a higher spiritual level to adjure to move away from any kind of meat eating, which is purely a concession to this negative dimension of the human, like, instincts.
Would you say that there might be a need today to eat meat from a spiritual level? As you say,
well obviously I'm presenting certain sources that are in keeping with my own particular perspective. I obviously cannot deny that there are those amongst my colleagues who would strongly disagree with that. But my arguments, therefore, have less to do with the principle that we're talking about now and more with the practice that you want to talk about later. Because on the issue of the practice, there I can argue absolutely, because I can actually demonstrate, I think, effectively, the problematics of eating meat today. But on principle, I can only point to these sources which affirm, I would say on the basis of the text, that meat eating is not a desirable ideal, but a concession. But that, as we said, there have been times and places where it was probably necessary as well. Today, we can have all our necessary nutrients from sources without needing to kill, and without being party to the mass slaughter and the barbarism that goes off in the livestock industry. So I would say that today it is a moral choice, but for me, moral and religious are totally inextricably bound up with one another. There isn't such a thing for me that is moral that is not religious, or that is religious and is not moral.
And indeed, that is the way that it should be. There's a concept of not changing a precedent set by a preceding generation.
Now we get into more practical areas. And yes. In fact, let me backtrack. No, to some extent, you are raising an important principle. I mean, we have no right to make ourselves appear more virtuous than generations before us. But as we've already said, circumstances were not always the same, and therefore the needs and the demands of places change from time to time. And the whole of our halakhic corpus recognizes that and applies that to changes. And more, we now come to a situation of where, even if you could argue, and there would be those who would argue, that meat eating is a mitzvah in certain time and place, nevertheless, at best it would be today, mitzvah haba ba'avira, a legitimate goal that comes through illegitimate means, which according to halakha is then rendered illegitimate. In other words, Judaism teaches as an ethical value, not only must ends be legitimate, but means must be legitimate as well. And today we face a situation where the means are illegitimate in many, many ways, which I'm very happy to elaborate.
Let's talk about that. Would you consider that meat today, cattle halachically slaughtered by the highest hechsher in the land, would you say that it's kosher?
So, let me backtrack a little bit on that as well and start with my own personal experiences. I was newlywed with my wife when we came out to South Africa initially as the Shaliach to the student organizations. Before it was sorted, it was school Saturday. And we came out, and I was quite a heavy meat eater. And in South Africa, the kosher meat was fantastic. I mean, I was eating steak or lamb chops or something almost every day. I didn't always think that it was seemed the most noble thing to be doing, but I always used to say I would like to be vegetarian, but I like meat too much. And what really clinched it was when I was rabbi in Sea Point and I was on the bed in there, I had to go to the slaughterhouses to check on the shochtim. Now, I knew everything about what goes on there. I'd studied it. After all, the vast majority of the examination for smicha, for an Orthodox smicha, deals with shchita, with kashrut, with trefot, with basal chalav, with all these other areas, etc. So I was familiar with it, but I'd actually never been in a slaughterhouse. And certainly never been in a slaughterhouse seeing the whole process from beginning to end. And there were many interesting things. There was also an opportunity for me to compare the situation in the non-Jewish section of the slaughterhouses, because the Jewish area of the slaughterhouse was part of the larger complex as well. And that's another topic for discussion. But the big problem for me at the beginning was I was horrified by what I saw. And I wouldn't want to do it. I'm not in any way, God, disparaging the shochtim who do it out of the most selfless motives and with total devotion. But I personally wouldn't want to do it. So I faced a moral problem now, which is it right for me to benefit from that which I wouldn't want to do myself? And that was the beginning. But then I became much more aware of other issues. First of all, the conditions of transportation. And there is an issur in the Torah of Tzar Balei Chaim. You mustn't cause suffering to animals. Now, it's true that as the Torah does mandate and allow us to eat animal flesh, there obviously there's a compromise there. A certain amount of animal suffering is by definition allowed. The question is how much? And the majority of halachic opinion is of claims that it has to be a tzorech chiyuni or a tzorech hechrechi. It has to be an essential necessary part in order to be able to facilitate the needs of human beings. And the conditions under which they're transported to be able to meet human demand are not at all, I would say, in keeping with the teachings that Judaism propounds regarding compassion for animals. But then I learned other things. Then I learned about not only how the animals are transported, but how the animals are grown, the livestock process, that they are injected with hormones and antibiotics, because being able to provide for the demand of the masses, which grows, has grown and grown on such a large scale, means what we call factory farming. Masses of animals are brought together under conditions which are not healthy, not hygienic, and to be able to deal with the possibility of transmission of diseases, the animals have to be filled with antibiotics in order to be able to combat disease. Those antibiotics are retained back into the human flesh when they are eaten. It makes us resistant to antibiotics and makes us vulnerable to all kinds of plagues and pandemics. In addition, in order to maximize the animal flesh for human consumption, these animals are pumped with hormones. The hormones are retained within the flesh and are also therefore taken in by human beings. And there is a clear, I read a number of studies already then in South Africa, of the correlation between various forms of cancers and meat eating. And it became very clear to me already then, very early on, that this is not a healthy thing to do, to be able to consume all this kind of product. And there is an issur in the Torah against doing harm to yourself. Shmartem od nafshotechem. There's a whole section of the Shulchan Aruch that's devoted to how we take our responsible care of ourselves. And to take in any form of poisonous product or product that is actually going to damage our health is also prohibited. And certainly if there are people who are going to be affected by the hormone imbalances, by the antibiotics, etc., these become therefore clear reasons to eschew such products. In other words, what I'm saying is, if we had ideal farmyard conditions, under which animals were treated respectfully, as they were in the days of our great-grandparents, and if where they were not rendered almost senseless by the kind of things that pumped into them, and where these things were not coming back into our human bodies as a result, then it could be a very different situation. But today, The mass demand means, unfortunately, mass barbarism, and we are parties to it. And we are parties to activities like, for example, all male chicks that are born are immediately killed. Either they're thrown in a grinder live, or they're suffocated in plastic bags. Why? Because these chicks are no value. They don't produce eggs, and therefore they're not used for the market. When we buy eggs, we are party to those barbarisms. There is an issue here of you shall not fall a stumbling block in front of a blind man. You are a collaborator in an offensive act. You bear a certain amount of guilt for that. And therefore encouraging such production means that we share in its responsibility. And in dairy products, not only is the whole question of the way dairy cows are treated, and are again pumped again with these hormones to grow these enormous udders to produce maximum milk output in which they can barely move as a result. The animals very often that are kept together are dehorned because they might harm one another. That's generally done without anesthetic, just burnt off them. The conditions are quite horrific for dairy cows. But also the way these cows are produced, are grown in order to be able to maximize their output leads to internal distortions. And there's a fascinating thing. One of the Rashi Yeshiva of Yeshiva University, Rabbi Herschel Schachter, had heard information about the fact that cows today are being produced in a manner that distorts their inner organs. Now, when you slaughter an animal for kosher consumption of its flesh, you can see what organs are in a good state and what are not. And today, more and more animals are not, incidentally, and then they are not used for kosher meat, which to a large degree, of course, puts up the price of kosher meat, which is another matter. But there is another principle, and that is that the derivative from a non-kosher animal is not kosher. And therefore, milk that comes from a non-kosher animal is not kosher. That applies if it's a naturally born non-kosher animal. It also applies if the animal has been rendered itself non-kosher through various actions, such as disease, that have made the internal organs non-kosher. He went and he checked on dairy cows after they had finished, if you like, their output as dairy cows, and looked at the innards that were exposed and therefore open, and found them all non-kosher, or at least not all, but a very high proportion of these animals was non-kosher. And he realized that if the majority were non-kosher animals, as Rob, he couldn't drink the milk anymore. So his decision was based simply upon the fact that the laws of kashrut led him to make that conclusion. But I would say beyond the laws of kashrut is the goal of kashrut. And often we get so preoccupied with the technical nitty-gritty of halakha, as important as it is, we lose sight of its purpose. We confuse the wood for the trees. And what is the purpose? There are three different sources in our sages where they say, what does God care about how you slit the throat of an animal? But the mitzvot were only given in order to refine the human person. Tzarev et habriyot. In other words, kashrut is meant to make us more refined people. It's meant to make us more compassionate and sensitive people. And both Nachmanides and disagree on exactly what the impact of compassion to animals is, agree that kashrut and the way we kill animals and prepare it is precisely meant to reflect compassion and imbue us with compassion. Now, if we are party to this barbaric industry that is more barbaric today than ever before, that involves behavior that our ancestors could not have even contemplated and would be horrified to know about, and the truth of the matter is, we're only really able to do it because we don't know about it. Most people really knew about all the material information I'm giving to you and could see it with their own eyes. They would behave differently. But ignorance of the law does not mean that you are no longer responsible for your actions. And therefore today, being party to this is nothing less, in my opinion, than a chilul Hashem, a desecration of God's name. To say that products have come through such cruelty and such harm that is once again retained into the human person, and to say that that's kosher seems to me to be a desecration of God's name. Moreover, there are other issues today. The United Nations study has shown that the livestock industry causes more pollution to our environment than all the forms of transport all put together. That's stunning, because it's not just pollution that's coming from methane gas. It's the destruction of arable lands. It's the destruction of the rainforest. It's the waste of water. all these different things together are waste. Now, waste is another prohibition in the Torah. Bal tashrit. You're not allowed to waste. And indeed, any form of wasted is considered to be an impiety because actually you're behaving with disparagement, with disregard for God's provision. So you mustn't waste. Children in good, observant Jewish homes have always been taught not to waste food. And that applies, of course, on a large scale as well to our world. More than that, there is a question of justice. There are people starving in our world. There is enough food for human need. There is not enough food for human greed. And it's the greedy that are preventing the needy from being able to benefit from. If we adopted in our Western world more modest lifestyles, we would have resources to be able to ensure that we could share. As we said on Yom Kippur, what did we say? God says, do I want a fast in which you're just moaning and groaning? I want a fast in which you share your bread with the hungry, where you loosen the fetters of those in bondage. I want to see your religion lead you to acts of justice and righteousness. And if your religion is in some way collaborating with inhumanity and misbehavior and disregard for the environment, for the well-being of others, and encouraging the possibility of disease and damage, then you are not leading a truly religious life.
How much support is there amongst the rabbinate for what you're saying?
Well, of course, this is very threatening for the rabbinate.
And why is that?
It's threatening not just in terms of norms and therefore the way we behaved yesterday, and religion by definition is a very conservative institution and tends always to, if you like, sanctify that which went before. But it's a real threat because, as I was saying before, the whole process of rabbinic authority is overwhelmingly wrapped up with kashrut. The smicha, the rabbinic ordination, is based on kashrut. If you eliminate all these different areas, you lift the criteria for determining rabbinic authority. That is itself a little bit scandalous, because why should the whole of rabbinic authority be completely preoccupied with kashrut? But because kashrut was such a complex technical area, it became the major area of rabbinic expertise and competence. But today, for smicha, we shouldn't just be focusing on kashrut. There are so many other issues of Jewish life that should be the syllabus for the qualification of rabbis to be able to serve communities. That's another matter on its own. But then we come to the whole question of the financial aspects. And the kashrut is an enormous business. And you've got mashkichim, and you've got rabbis involved, and you've got batei din, and therefore it's all wrapped up together. So the idea that we could therefore adopt a plant-based diet and eliminate all needs to be consumed animal products is seen as very, very threatened by the rabbinic establishment.
Can you imagine how few things would need a heksha? Because you don't need a heksha for food and vegetables. But
we shouldn't get rid of a heksha. We should make sure that the heksha is a moral heksha. So you should have a heksha on products where you pay your workers a decent living wage. If you don't pay your workers a decent living wage, you should not be able to get a heksha for your products. You should have a heksha on a criteria of cleanliness, of moral rectitude, of the way of these values, which are the values of Abraham, our father, we are told. In fact, the Gemara in Beit Zaz says, 32b, if you are not compassionate, then it's a sign that you may not truly be of the seed of Abraham. And the Torah is explicit, the way of Abraham is the way of justice and righteousness. So it's not that these things are unimportant. And even with regards to a plant-based diet, there are still issues where you need to inspect against worms and against creepy crawlies, against other things, you still need that inspection. And there are areas that also relate to, maybe if they come from Eretz Israel, Masrot and Tumot, even though that's Midrabanan, question Ola. So there are still a number of issues that do need kashrut. But kashrut should not purely be a matter of technicality. It should be a matter of teleology, the goal, the principle, the moral values that it's meant to experience.
You said something earlier about that the Torah allows for a certain amount of animal suffering. What is the source for that? I haven't heard that before. I mean, I've even heard we told you can't overload your donkey.
That's
right? True. The fruit of the law, and there's the word of the law, the letter of the law.
But you can load your donkey.
You can load your donkey.
But using your metaphor, your reference, You can load your donkey, you can't overload your donkey. So now I don't imagine donkeys want to be loaded. So there's a bit of inconvenience to be loaded. The question is how much inconvenience? And there's always a situation where one's got to find the right line. So the most famous truva is that of the Trumata Deshen. It deals with the whole question of plucking geese and when they were still, when the geese were not dead, and plucking feathers and things like that. And, but for example, in modern times, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, arguably the greatest posek of modern times, has made it perfectly clear that pâté de foie gras, goose liver, which is made by taking geese and restricting their mobility, in most places traditionally, they were actually buried in the earth so that only their necks were outside. Today there are clamps which grab these geese and keep them there so they can be force-fed. They are force-fed. They don't want to eat. They're force-fed so that basically their liver bursts. It grows, and therefore they can't even function anymore. And that produces the delicacy that we call pâté de foie gras. And believe it or not, a gross chilul Hashem, you can find pâté de foie gras with a heksher. But Rav Moshe Feinstein said it's clear that this is completely in contradiction. That's cruelty that goes beyond what I said before, the Trumat Adeshen identifies as the necessary need in order to be able to provide for the need of humanity. Or, for example, the question which Rabbi Moshe Feinstein has also addressed, and also the Rabbi Yosef, veal. Veal, what's called white meat in Israel, is essentially the product of taking a calf and shackling it and keeping it in the dark so that it becomes totally anemic, and therefore it doesn't have normal colored blood or healthy conditions. Then it's slaughtered, and that meat comes onto people's plates, and it's called kosher. It's outrageous. It's total cruelty for cruelty's sake, simply for human indulgence. And there's no need. In other words, this is not where you have to say, my body needs meat. We need meat in order to be healthy. And therefore, to kill a cow in the right kosher manner, to be able to provide that meat. And they're not saying it shouldn't be tasty. I'm not saying people shouldn't be able to enjoy their food. But today, these conditions with regards to the livestock industry are so horrific and have been, as I said, driven not only by demand, but by human avarice, greed, indulgence that is totally insensitive to animal life and to their well-being.
And very far away from the spirit of the law. You know, it's interesting. There was a conversation on High FM about this plant-based product. You know, you get these plant-based burgers and plant-based sausages and things like that. And I'm not talking about soya. I'm talking made from peas and other materials. They've now brought out a pork one, which for all intents and purposes is completely pyro. It is vegan. It's kosher. But the OU has ruled that it is not kosher because it is representing pork. So how is that we can be acting outside of the law in so many cases? And it's almost like the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing when it comes to kashrut.
Well, that's true in so many different ways in so many places, even in Israel, where there's a central control. And that's another reason for becoming a vegetarian, because very often you can't even be sure that things are being done, even if we leave aside all the issues we've spoken about, that things are really being done properly. And often for financial gain, people will do all kinds of hanky-pankies with other dealers and different sources coming in there, for you can't always be absolutely sure where it's coming from 100%, and therefore, not for nothing are there so many other sources that say that the Talmid Chacham should adjourn not eat meat. That's actually stated in the name of the Ari and brought also by the Mishnah Berurah. And the Gemara itself says a person should not teach his son to eat meat. So there's even therefore a statement there within the Gemara that's quite explicit in that regard. But as I say, there are different opinions on that, and I can understand, even though personally I don't agree with it, but I can understand those that would be concerned here with a matter of marit ayin, the way things appear, and that if people are seen to eat products or identified with a source that is non-kosher, it may come to lead to confusion, and therefore they want to avoid that confusion. I can understand that. But I think today, you know, things are marketed with tastes in a way that they weren't before. And I don't think anybody that sees something that's called barbecue such and such necessarily assumes that it has any kind of content. So any kind of industrial product today probably needs a Herrscher in order to check what's in it, because we don't know today so many areas. As I say, I would like these Herrschers to also be based on health criteria and not simply upon the other technicalities, but we've still got a way to go in that regard. So the issue of Herrscherim is a more complex one. But I think that in the end, the plea I'm making here as a moral, as a spiritual, as a religious plea, is going to succeed not because of any of my arguments. It's going to succeed for simple economic reasons. Eating meat is going to become simply economically unviable, especially as these alternative products come onto the market, with increasing numbers buying them, especially as we also now have cultured meat and products that will come from some original cell, but no longer will there be any need for any kind of killing, etc. And that raises interesting questions about whether it be fleshic or whether it be parva. In fact, again, that comes back to your question before. Most halachic opinions dealing with this issue today think that cultured meat is parva. But there are those that want it to be categorized as fleshic, as meat, so that we don't have any kind of confusion. But at any rate, it means our industry, this industry is changing rapidly. And if, as humanity, as societies, what we should be worrying about now is the well-being of these farmers. We should be worrying about people with pork diseases. We should be worrying about the livelihood of butchers. We should be worrying about the livelihood of people who have been involved in factory farming, because these people are going to lose their livelihood very soon. And we need to be helping them as societies move towards a plant-based industry. They need to be teaching them how to use their land differently, how to use their skills differently, how to diversify their own particular industries and trade. This should be a responsibility which kashrut authorities should be taking upon themselves, because ultimately it's in their interest to be party to this move away from meat products, which I believe is inexorable. Within a matter of just two generations, we will look back and say, how on earth did people actually behave? Just as we look today and we actually tend to look at smokers as pariahs, and we've brought to banish them from public spaces, when only a matter of 20, 30 years ago, they were normative. So the same attitude will eventually develop with regards to them.
Well, I hope so, because listen to these figures. This comes from the World Economic Forum. 200 million animals are killed for food around the world every day. Get your head around that figure. 200 million animals are killed for food around the world every day, and that's just on land. If you include wild-caught and farmed fishes, you get a total closer to 3 billion animals killed daily. Is that not just staggering?
It is, Kathy.
This is Community in Conversation with Kathy Kayla, starting conversations that matter.
Rabbi, what makes an animal kosher? And I'm talking about beyond the cud and the cloven hooves. Do we just take it at face value that this is the animal that's kosher? As long as we're doing kosher shchita, everything's good.
Well, I suppose the answer to that is yes. I mean, the believing Jew, very often described as orthodox, is one who accepts the commandments of the Torah. But the commandment here is conditional. So you have many kind of conditional commandments in the Torah. So I'm not comparing this to divorce, but it's an easy example to turn to. The Torah has a mandate for divorce. There's a specific way to go about performing a divorce. Of course, then you've got the Torah Shebal Peh, the generations that develop that. But the Torah lays down a certain procedure. Now, the Torah is not saying that a divorce is an ideal. On the contrary. Divorce is a very unhappy thing. But for Judaism, it's better that two people go their separate ways rather than stay together, rather than unhappy. So there's a procedure to accommodate an undesirable situation. And therefore, from my particular perspective, and of course I base myself on others, meat eating is a concession. But when people want to eat meat, then there is a particular way in which it needs to be done. And there are some particular animals that one may consume and others that one may not. Why may one consume these animals and why not others? That, of course, the Torah is not explicit about it. Jewish mysticism very often tries to explain the significance. And there have even been biologists who suggest that Judaism is very conscious about leaving those animals which are important from an environmental point of view, especially the garbage cleaners of an animal world, so that they will be able to process our environment correctly. There are even theories, of course, with regards to the idea of health. None of that the Torah talks about. The Torah speaks about the idea of holiness. And holiness is essentially God consciousness, so that we are conscious about what we eat, when we eat, and how we eat. From my point of view, a plant-based diet is one level above that. It is a higher consciousness even in that regard. But as to why the Torah permits you to eat, we don't eat grasshoppers today amongst Ashkenazi Jews, but the Torah has a mandate that allows you to eat grasshoppers that has leg joints above its body as opposed to those with leg joints beneath their body. I mean, there's no logical explanation to that. This is part, if you like, of the chok, of the injunction that we follow. And above all, it is binding us, if you like, to the generations of our ancestors, to Jews around the world. But bottom line is, yes, we accept it because the Torah has mandated that. But as I said before, the Torah mandates many things that we can do without and that maybe should do without. Another example would be slavery as well. The Torah mandates. Certainly Chazal, our sages, did not see this as an ideal. But if one was going to do it, then there were certain conditions under which it was to take place.
Does the Torah take into consideration the life of an animal as a factor that contributes to whether that animal is kosher or not?
No, all animals are described as living beings, and therefore where the concept of nefesh comes into play, and therefore all sentient beings, as indeed the whole cosmos, is a manifestation of the divine. That, of course, has ramifications with regards to our environmental responsibility, because any degradation, let alone diminution of species, is in a sense a degradation, diminution of the divine presence in our world. We say our world is not some freak accident, it's a creation, and therefore is a manifestation of that divine intelligence that we call God, and therefore have to respect it accordingly. And obviously the Torah describes gradations in that regard. From the inanimate to the animate, from sentient beings to the human beings, that we are not all equal in the Torah's conception. Humanity is at the top of the chain, literally, as far as the Torah is concerned. But that doesn't give us the right to behave as we choose. On the contrary, it places greater responsibility on us to behave towards other creatures. And of course, Ashrei, Psalm 145 that we recite daily, number of times, says God's mercies extend to all his creatures, and we are told to emulate the divine qualities, so we are called to be merciful to all God's creatures and to be cognizant of our responsibility to the environment as a whole. But there's nothing explicit with regard, I mean, you have, there are quotations, for example, also in Mishlei, that the righteous considers the life of the beast. In other words, that the one is attentive to animal feelings in certain areas in that regard. But there's nothing halachically explicit in that regard, other than, of course, what we've described, what we've discussed before, and that is a prohibition against cruelty to animals. So even within that very prohibition is a recognition that animals suffer and that being cruel to them is bad. There's, as I mentioned in passing, there's a debate between Rambam and Ramban, Maimonides and Nachmanides, whether the prohibitions regarding to animals are there because animals themselves suffer pain, and therefore we need to be concerned about animal pain. That's the Maimonidean position. Or to say, no, you can never compare animal pain to human pain. But the important reason why you shouldn't cause animals pain is because of how this impacts upon your human soul. And if you behave with insensitivity, this makes you even more into an insensitive person. The more you behave with compassion, the more compassionate a human being you become, the more godlike you become, because compassion is the mark, therefore, as we mentioned before, of the true children of Abraham and of the godly quality.
If we look at Torah, we even see that all of our top Jewish leaders were all shepherds, weren't they? Mm.
Most of them, certainly, yes. I mean, and that's also very interesting. The Gemara exactly describes that. And the Gemara, Chazal point out that point, and they add on a little midrash. Moshe Rabbeinu was the shepherd of Yitro, his father-in-law's flocks. who lived in Midian. How did he get to Har Sinai and to the burning bush? And the Midrash tells of the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu was looking after his flock and he discovered a little lamb had disappeared. The one was missing and he went looking for it. This obviously was quite a sturdy little lamb and it had gone quite a long way and he finds it by a brook or an oasis or whatever, slaking its thirst. And he says, oh, you were thirsty and that's why you went away and I didn't know. And he takes the lamb after it has had a drink and he puts it on his shoulders and he takes the lamb on his shoulders and walks it back to the flock. And a heavenly voice calls out, one who cares for the smallest lost lamb is the one who is deserving to take care of my flock, to take care of my people. So you have many examples, both explicit within Tanakh and sometimes Midrashic, talking about humans' relations to animals as a defining quality of leadership. And of course, Rivka, our mother, was selected as the appropriate wife for Yitzhak Avinu precisely because she cared for the camels and not only for the wayfarers and gave them to drink. And that was the sign that Eliezer divined was appropriate for her to be, therefore, the daughter-in-law of Avraham Avinu and the wife of Yitzhak. So you have many, many stories. The Gemara is also filled with examples of how one story even tells of how Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was plagued with terrible and suffered greatly because of his insensitivity towards a little calf that came to shelter with him who didn't want to be taken to the slaughterhouse. And Rabbi Yehuda says, go, for that you were created. And as a result, he was plagued with terrible suffering. In other words, compassion to animals must always be there for that compassion in and of itself.
And it speaks to character. You mentioned that eating meat is a concession. Where do we get that from? Where was the concession?
So the concession is first of all there, very obviously, after the flood, humanity is permitted to eat meat on the understanding that they cannot eat the blood and that the blood has to be eliminated. So here's a change, a sea change from the Garden of Eden to the conditions in the post-Noahide, post-Diluvian world. But the language is also very clear. And this Rav Kook points out in his writings, because the word ta'ava is lust. And lust is not a positive concept. It is therefore clear where the Torah says, if your hearts lust to eat meat, then this is the way to do it. In other words, it's clearly the language of concession.
There was another time also, wasn't there, when after the Jews leave Egypt?
Oh, you mean with the quails?
With the quails. That is another example.
Yes. I mean, the fact that when they asked for meat and they received the quails and as a result there was a plague and so many died from it is open to many different possible interpretations. There certainly are those that see that their request was an inappropriate request in the first place.
Why? Because prior to leaving Egypt, they had to have the Korban Pesach. The Korban Pesach was essentially the Jews taking an Egyptian god, which they had to tie to their bedstead for 2 weeks. Then they had to slaughter it in public view. They had to cook it. They had to eat it just themselves. They weren't allowed to share it with anybody. It was only their households. And they had to finish every part of it. Well, so that's quite specific in terms of being a commandment.
Generally, your description is right. There are a few mild inaccuracies with regards to time, or also the fact that you say correctly that the lamb was worshipped as a god, and that taking the lamb, just as with the 10 plagues, was, if you like, an assault on Egyptian idolatry. That's explicit in the Torah with regards to the 10 plagues. It's not explicit with regards to the Korban Pesach. So the idea that it was taking the Egyptian god as an act of defiance is not explicit in the Torah, but that's certainly the way it's been interpreted over many generations. And the Korban Pesach is the one thing, of course, that people always come up to me and say, what are you going to do about that when the temple is rebuilt? And I can answer everything else, because other korbanot, you don't have to bring animal korbanot. You can bring a vegetal meal substance for korbanot. But the Korban Pesach is clearly a matter of eating a bit of lamb. And so I say to them, well, when the Mashiach comes, if he says to me, David Rosen, once a year, you've got to have a bit of lamb, I'll do whatever the Mashiach tells me. But we'll see whether that's really what he says or whether he says We are now in a new reality when we will be able to celebrate Korban Pesach in a different way. Who knows? But if that's what I have to do, that's what I have to do.
It's interesting how science is more in line today with Torah than it's ever been. So, for example, all the kosher animals have something that non-kosher animals don't, and that is called the circle of Willis. The circle of Willis is a circle of blood vessels in the head. Human beings also have it, but only kosher animals have it. And what happens is during kosher slaughter, it causes the animal to bleed out faster. The same thing with the chok of the red heifer. Why would the ashes of this animal, you know, when something is dead, it is tameh, it is impure. And yet it helps to purify people who are impure. Today we understand homeopathy, it's like cures like. My question for you is, if our forefathers were alive today, do you think that they would still eat meat?
Well, in a sense, we are our forefathers. We are their descendants. And therefore, the question is for us. And it's clear that we are eating meat. But as I said to you before, I think that's going to disappear very, very quickly. I'm sure many people be shocked, and many would even laugh to hear me say that. But I think they're going to be really surprised how quickly that's going to disappear. And for me, this is, in fact, is a manifestation of spirituality in our times. I think our modern world and many young people very often far away from traditional religious forms are nevertheless inspired in a spiritual search in many ways. And I believe that vegetarianism and veganism in particular is a manifestation of that spirit. It's a manifestation of the divine presence in the human soul that is struggling to be able to find those ways of expression. I'm not sure, you know, we can find ways to explain kashrut in scientific terms. I'm not sure how fully satisfactory they are. I'm not sure how necessary they are. But I think that the teleology, the goal in which kashrut is taking us, clearly designed as Rav Kook expounds so beautifully in the book that was collated by his greatest Talmid, the Nazir, Rabbi David Cohen, in the book called The Vision of Vegetarianism and Peace, where they're taken from all his different sources, how all the different mitzvot, especially with regards to the process of shchita and kashrut, are all designed to wean us away from this activity to a plant-based diet. And I think that we are seeing this, if you like, messianic ideal slowly coming about in our times. Very often, not necessarily by the most frum amongst us, which is interesting. So very often the most spiritual, the most religiously motivated are not the most frum. Now, I'm not saying that means that you shouldn't be frum. I want people to be frum. But I want people to be frum in accordance and in consonance with that spirit, which very often comes from other sources.
Very interesting that, because sometimes we do get involved. We get so involved with the minutiae of hechshers and checking and all of that, that we actually lose sight of the bigger picture, which is something that you actually started off saying at the beginning of this interview.
Yes, and sometimes it can be worse, because sometimes we can get so obsessive that we allow these aspects of religious life to be tools of judgmentalism, of judging others, which of course our sages continuously warn us against. But you get to this sort of phenomenon, and my Hersher is greater than your Hersher, and it's, if you like, one up on the Cohens as to who can be. And you get there's some ridiculous situations where the next thing we'll know, they'll have putting stamps on the water taps of different things, because almost everything therefore now is being somehow itemized. Kashrut has become sort of a kind of politicization of religion for political advantage. And that's very, very dangerous. And the only way to serve as an antidote to that is to continuously be conscious of the spiritual and moral goals of kashrut.
I'm just looking for a source here. It's the Handbook of Jewish Thought. I'm sure you've read this book. It's Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan. I just want to have a look at the source. He talks about there's a belief that in the third Beis HaMikdash, there won't be any animal sacrifices.
So that's based on a midrash that says in the future, all offerings will be annulled except for the gift offering. And that gift offering can be a meal offering. It doesn't mean it has to be, but it can be. And therefore, that's the basis that Rav Kook uses to be able to describe Messianic Age as a totally vegan society.
Either way, let's hope that the world is moving to a more compassionate, caring, loving, godly space.
Amen.
Rabbi David Rosen, thank you so much for your time, for your expertise, for sharing your passion with me. I really, really appreciate it, and I feel very, very honored that you've made time this morning to speak to us.
Thank you. All the best, Kathy.
God bless. Shabbat Shalom. That was Rabbi David Rosen. He is the former chief rabbi of Ireland. He currently serves as the American Jewish Committee's International Director of Interreligious Affairs. He was appointed commander of the Order of the British Empire, that's a CBE, by Queen Elizabeth II. He was appointed by King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia to establish the KAICIID Dialogue Center, that is an interfaith center. This is a top-level guy. And when you've got great thinkers who are setting a precedent, we need to sit up and we need to hear their message. We might not agree with them, but we need to at least be secure enough to listen. Jewish laws form the framework for life, from the existential to the minutiae of tying our own shoelaces. It's all there in the written and the oral laws. The Torah governs life, how we behave, what we stand for, how we live, how we love, how we pray, what comes out of our mouths, and what we put into our mouths. We need to look at the spirit of the law and the letter of the law to understand and apply them. But that is another conversation. I wish you and yours a Shabbat Shalom, dear friends. This is Kathy Kaler for Community in Conversation.
It's a Community in Conversation. Join Kathy Kaler every Friday at 9 a.m. for Community in Conversation. Be brave enough to start a conversation that matters. Right here on 101.9 High FM.